Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Cristina Gortázar from the University Pontificia of Madrid and director of the Institute for International Migrations at Comillas, at the University Comillas in Madrid. I am glad to be here and I thank to the organization. I am going to moderate this workshop on expulsion and return forcé, on expulsion and return. I do understand perfectly Portuguese and French, but I prefer to speak English. We are going to hear the rapporteur. He is Thomas Monard. He is a lawyer working in the Ministry of Interior of Hungary and dealing with immigration law, especially with illegal or irregular migration, visa policies, and stateless persons. Besides, also, Thomas Monard, besides his work at the ministry, he teaches public international law in the University of Budapest as a part-time job. But sorry for waiting a bit. I'm going to introduce also Nuala Moll and Olivier Ver. C'est Ver ou Vier? Ver. Nuala Moll is the director and also what it is more founder of the Advice on Individual Rights in Europe. Initially, she was an expert on immigration and asylum. Through the years, she is very recognized expert in all the different subjects regarding international human rights. She has worked on the relationship between the European Convention on Human Rights and, of course, the European jurisprudence of the Strasbourg Court and the relationship with the European Union freedom of movement. She has participated in more than 70 cases at the Court of Strasbourg. And I'm not going to read all what I have taken from her CV because I have no many minutes and I need to be very strict with the minutes of my colleagues, so I need to be strict also with myself. Then we are going afterwards to hear to Olivier Ver. He has worked his whole life for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and he has spent his career for the High Commissioner in Africa. She has been recently designated to Strasbourg, and currently he is the representative of the High Commissioner for Refugees in the Council of Europe. So both Nuala and Olivier will take the floor afterwards, Thomas. First of all, I would like to introduce the subject of this workshop. It is expulsion and forced return. I would like just to say something, two or three concepts, probably that we all know already here. First of all, I would like to remember all of you the principle of non-refoulement that protects asylum seekers, but not only asylum seekers, also recognize refugees, of course, from being returned in any manner whatsoever to the country of origin or to any transit country where their life or fundamental freedoms will be in a serious risk. So there is the direct refoulement and there are indirect refoulement. Second, no refoulement is not only a refugee law principle, as is this at the Geneva Convention 1951 Article 33. It is indeed a human rights law rule, which is at the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights of 1966, also at the Convention Against Torture of 1984, etc., and this regarding the universal level, because here in Europe it is up to the European Convention on Human Rights and especially to the European Court on Human Rights. It is a rule of absolute character, a jus cogens rule with imperative character, no derogation, no exception. Third, it doesn't mean, all this does not mean that the states could not, should not expel migrants, aliens, from their territories as a matter of sovereignty. What it means is that there are some limits regarding those expulsions. First limit, it is not allowed to proceed to collective expulsions of migrants or aliens in any occasion. This is an international customary rule, well codified in international instruments and treaties. Another limit, return of any alien migrant needs to be conducted in conditions of dignity. All these ideas are going to be developed by the table, but by my colleagues here with me. Third limitation, states need to be sure that are not expelling anyone beneficiary of the refugee condition regarding the Geneva Convention or any other international protection status. For example, subsidiary protection status in the European Union, which protects persons from death penalty, from torture and inhuman treatment or punishment, and also from general violence, etc. And other limitation, which comes now, that includes any situation of protection which is not under the so-called directive on qualifications, but these limits to the sovereignty of the state includes any situation of protection under the European Convention on Human Rights and out the directive on qualification. Could be the protection of Article 2 or 3, of course, but also others. For example, aid on the right to a private and family life. There is something that I think that probably Nuala will try afterwards, which is very bizarre. The European Union 27, we have we have passed a directive, the so-called substantive directive or qualification directive, in which the noble ulama, this is up to you, Nula, but I'm trying to open the possible debate afterwards, in which noble ulama has not anymore an absolute character. So, because the directive includes a situation in which the subsidiary protection and in the possibility to exclude from subsidiary protection persons who are nevertheless protected by law of ulama or other tools from the European Convention on Human Rights and especially from the European Court on Human Rights. So I am not so sure if we are in a very schizophrenic system in which the Europe of 47 has something and the Europe of 27 have something different and no coherence at all between them. So here we are not only going to speak on the Nora Fulama. I think that Olivier is going to tackle the issue of Nora Fulama, but also readmission agreements. And Thomas is going to tackle this other issue. Readmission agreements of mixed flows of persons. When a state didn't give them the asylum, the mixed flows of persons, the occasion to ask for asylum, this situation in which in a mixed flow of persons, the readmission agreement does not take care of distinguishing between potential asylum seekers and other migrants, this is against international law. Then we are going to speak also on Dublin, Dublin II, on the regulation of Dublin, which is Dublin II, because Dublin I was the convention of Dublin. And we know all that Dublin II established the criteria between the European Union 27 to decide who is the state, the member state, responsible to examine each asylum claim. Well, here the controversial or dangerous issue is that without harmonization of the European asylum law, the European material, a substantive asylum law, it is dangerous sometimes to apply the Dublin Convention. I know that on those 10 years since Tampere, since the Treaty of Amsterdam, we have done many, we have proved and passed, I mean the European Union, many directives and regulations and decisions, but on asylum matters are all minimum rules. So the procedural and substantive asylum is not harmonized enough in some cases to can transfer the responsibility. This is an issue in the case of MSS versus La Belgique on the and Greece, yes, on the issue of sending or not sending an asylum seeker to Greece. So this is not only something that people from the academia we are saying since many months ago, but now it's an issue to the court. So this is something to debate afterwards with you. Now, I would like to pass the floor to my colleagues, to the experts here with me. But first of all, I would like to try to ask them to show us, to teach us the best practice to do the right work. The Stockholm program of this Christmas and for the next 5 years proposed the a communication on the evaluation, for example, of all the readmission agreements, and the Stockholm programs proposed to include better support measures for the agreements and also better means for the reintegration of persons returned. That this is good news. And also another issue, there are many at the Stockholm program, is to improve the training of anybody in on the civil servants all around the 27 entering in touch with the asylum seekers or with the mixed flows in the very first moment. It is not easy to distinguish between migrants, aliens, and persons in need of international protection. But in the European Union, we are spending huge amounts of money in other tasks. So we can use our money in training and trying to do this better, because we cannot ask the politicians that human rights is something so difficult to apply that nobody is going to reach. No, we need to speak of human rights and international law and European Union law and Strasbourg case law in a way that it can be not easy but possible for our politicians and for our civil servants to apply human rights and apply human rights when treating and where tackling immigration and especially irregular migration. So after that, I think that the floor is for Thomas. Olivier Baer. Thank you very much, Olivier. You have 15 minutes.
Merci, Madame la Modératrice. Alors, je vais quand même prendre de mes 15 minutes pour remercier les autorités portugaises de nous avoir reçus dans cette merveilleuse ville de Lisbonne. Et ce sera avec regret que je repartirai vers Strasbourg. J'aurais bien prolongé mon séjour. Je voudrais également dire, avant de commencer, que on peut devenir un expert que par les contributions des gens que nous rencontrons. J'ai beaucoup appris des réfugiés sur le terrain, et donc j'espère également qu'avec vos contributions, j'apprendrai encore plus sur le sujet. Je pense aussi que je vais essayer de ne pas trop être technique sur le non-refoulement, parce que pas mal des principes juridiques sont connus de vous-même, mais je vais essayer plutôt de parler de l'importance du respect du principe de non-refoulement. Cette importance est évidente à mes yeux. Lorsqu'on parle du principe de non-refoulement, lorsqu'on parle des retours forcés, il ne s'agit pas seulement de statistiques, et la chaire, nous sommes bons dans les statistiques, mais je ne vais pas vous faire de statistiques aujourd'hui, parce que nous parlons de retours forcés d'êtres humains. Il n'y a pas un jour sans que l'on ouvre la presse et qu'on voit des articles sur, voilà ici, on va reprendre les retours forcés vers le Zimbabwe, 12 Afghans en voie d'expulsion vers la Grèce et les Pays-Bas. Et donc c'est un sujet brûlant, un sujet qui concerne, comme on l'a dit, non seulement les réfugiés, mais également les migrants, les demandeurs d'asile. Et nous savons également qu'au cours de ces dernières années, ces mouvements migratoires dont on a parlé depuis hier sont devenus de plus en plus complexes. Nous savons également qu'ils sont mixtes dans leur nature. Un bon exemple est ce qui se passe en ce moment en France à Calais. Et en effet, toutes ces personnes voyagent ensemble, ces personnes utilisent les mêmes modes de transport, ils ont recours aux mêmes passeurs et ils sont exposés aux mêmes risques et abus durant leur voyage. Cependant, leurs motivations diffèrent, on l'a déjà dit. Pour certains, fuir leur pays est l'unique moyen de rester en vie, tandis que pour d'autres, quitter leur pays est, ne relève pas d'une telle crainte de persécution. Il faut donc maintenir la distinction entre ces différentes catégories de migrants, particulièrement lorsqu'il s'agit de traiter du retour ou de leur expulsion. Si l'on considère donc le terme migrant dans son sens large, à savoir des personnes qui quittent leur pays pour un autre, alors oui, les réfugiés sont des migrants. Mais si l'on considère le terme, et c'est ce qui est important pour la chaire, sous l'angle de la cause de départ, à savoir quitter, non pas quitter son pays par choix délibéré, mais quitter son pays forcé par les circonstances afin de fuir la persécution, alors non, les réfugiés ne sont pas des migrants. Leur objectif immédiat est la recherche de protection et non un but migratoire. C'est d'ailleurs pour cette raison que renvoyer des migrants irréguliers vers leur pays d'origine, ou même conclure des accords de réadmission, on va en parler plus tard, n'est pas interdit par le droit international, dès lors que les personnes peuvent bénéficier à nouveau de la protection nationale de leur pays. On l'a dit également hier, important de le rappeler, les États restent souverains dans les décisions relatives à l'entrée et au séjour des étrangers sur leur territoire, et cela a été rappelé dans la conclusion du comité exécutif du HCR sur le retour des personnes qui n'ont pas besoin de protection internationale. En revanche, cette souveraineté des États ne peut s'exercer que si ces mêmes États respectent le principe de non-refoulement. Pour en revenir à l'expulsion qui nous préoccupe aujourd'hui, celle-ci est normalement la conséquence d'une décision de retour qui est prise en vertu du droit national et qui est adressée à une personne qui demandait la permission de s'installer sur ce territoire ou à une personne qui résidait sur celui-ci mais qui a perdu ce droit en contrevenant à la loi nationale. Le retour forcé, s'il est le résultat d'une procédure similaire, serait utilisé dans les cas où la personne, ayant reçu l'ordre de quitter le territoire, ne s'exécuterait pas et donc devrait y être contraint par les forces nationales. On l'a dit, les expulsions et les retours forcés concernent toutes les catégories de migrants. Un travailleur étranger ayant perdu son droit de séjourner sur le territoire, un demandeur d'asile dont la requête a été déboutée, les anciens étudiants qui demeurent sur le territoire national au-delà de leurs études, des étrangers, on le voit aussi de plus en plus, ayant commis des infractions criminelles graves ou suspectées de terrorisme, pour ne citer que les cas les plus fréquents. Toutes ces expulsions, ces retours forcés, puisqu'il s'agit d'êtres humains, peuvent avoir une incidence sur les droits de ces personnes. Et mettre en relation les expulsions et les retours forcés avec les droits de l'homme ouvre un champ très large de débat. Aussi, pour des questions de temps, je me concentrerai en tout cas dans mon propos sur le principe de non-refoulement et donc sur les personnes qui, sur les retours forcés de personnes qui ont en fait réclamé une protection internationale. À ce titre, plusieurs notions peuvent être abordées. Le principe fondamental de non-refoulement, je vais y venir, ses incidences sur la procédure d'asile et le risque de refoulement en chaîne en application du règlement de Dublin qu'un de mes collègues va aborder plus tard. Il est donc important de rappeler que les réfugiés, parce qu'ils n'ont plus de protection nationale, parce qu'ils sont dans une situation particulière, bénéficient d'un arsenal juridique propre. C'est pourquoi il ne faut pas les confondre avec les autres migrants. Ils sont reconnus comme un groupe particulier par tous les États qui ont ratifié la Convention de Genève de 1951 et son protocole de 1967. Les réfugiés bénéficient également des services d'une agence des Nations Unies, cela leur est particulier, le HCR, créé pour trouver des solutions à leurs problèmes de protection, et ceci en coopération avec les États. J'ai déjà dit que les réfugiés doivent souvent utiliser les mêmes routes que les autres migrants. Le problème, c'est qu'il y a également d'autres migrants qui essayent d'utiliser l'asile pour essayer d'obtenir un séjour temporaire ou un séjour permanent. Et cela contribue à semer la confusion dans les esprits de nombre de vos concitoyens, et évidemment cela a un impact sur la protection des réfugiés. L'abus des procédures d'asile, les coûts de ces procédures, la traite d'êtres humains, on en a parlé ce matin, le terrorisme, le manque de partage de responsabilités, sont des défis réels pour les États membres du Conseil de l'Europe, mais pour d'autres aussi, pas seulement en Europe, de l'Afrique du Sud à l'Australie, de l'Inde à la Jordanie, du Niger à la Libye. J'ai trouvé ces mêmes défis lorsque je travaillais en Afrique, les mêmes problèmes de retour, les mêmes problèmes de mise en œuvre de procédures d'asile, les mêmes problèmes de capacité pour les États. Et je tiens à dire que nombre de ces migrants ou nombre de ces réfugiés restent souvent dans les pays limitrophes aux pays d'origine, bien avant de pouvoir arriver en Europe. Alors, n'envisager comme unique réponse à ces défis que le durcissement des mesures de contrôle, des mesures restrictives en matière de visa, la criminalisation de la migration et même le refoulement des réfugiés, je pense, est contraire à la tradition humaniste et d'accueil de l'Europe. Je pense aussi que, et le HR pense cela, cela ne produit pas les effets escomptés, parce que de plus en plus de réfugiés ne peuvent avoir d'autres recours que la clandestinité, et ils sont traités comme tels, et donc ils sont parfois renvoyés sans même avoir eu le temps de pouvoir demander l'asile, sans même avoir eu l'accès à une procédure d'asile. Si des réfugiés sont pénalisés pour être rentrés irrégulièrement, s'ils n'ont pas accès aux procédures d'asile et s'ils sont renvoyés, menottés, malmenés vers des pays qui ne sont pas sûrs, où ils ne pourront pas bénéficier d'une procédure d'asile efficace, eh bien il s'agit tout simplement de violation de la Convention de Genève et du principe de non-refoulement. Pourquoi ? Parce que ce principe de non-refoulement est la pierre angulaire du droit international, de l'asile et des réfugiés. Il découle directement du droit de chercher asile qui est garanti par l'article 14 de la Déclaration universelle des droits de l'homme. Et ce principe traduit la volonté de la communauté internationale d'assurer à toute personne le respect de ses droits, et particulièrement le droit à la vie, à la liberté, à la sécurité, des droits qui nous sont chers en tant qu'êtres humains. L'énoncé du principe de non-refoulement apparaît dans de nombreux instruments juridiques, on l'a déjà dit, cela apparaît à l'article 19 de la Charte fondamentale de la Charte des droits fondamentaux de l'Union européenne, on trouve ce principe énoncé dans la directive Retour, on trouve ce principe énoncé dans la Convention contre la torture, et évidemment, en ce qui concerne la HR, il est également mentionné à l'article 33 de la Convention de 1951 relative au statut des réfugiés, il a déjà été lu par la modératrice, alors je ne vais pas le relire, je vais juste préciser qu'il implique qu'on ne puisse renvoyer de quelque manière que ce soit une personne vers un pays où sa vie serait menacée, de quelque manière que ce soit. La Convention européenne des droits de l'homme, on l'a également mentionné, ne mentionne pas le principe de refoulement en tant que tel ou le droit d'asile, mais les juges de Strasbourg se sont employés à le faire émerger de leur jurisprudence relative à l'article 3, et comme on l'a dit également, donc c'est un principe absolu reconnu par la Convention européenne des droits de l'homme. L'un des éléments clés du principe de non-refoulement, c'est évidemment la valeur purement déclarative et non constitutive de la reconnaissance du statut de réfugié. On est un réfugié parce qu'on a des problèmes de persécution et qu'à un moment donné, on est obligé de quitter son pays. Dès le moment où nous fouillons les persécutions, nous sommes des réfugiés. Après, c'est juste à nous de le dire aux autorités qui nous accueillent. Et donc, si une personne n'a pas exprimé dans un langage clair et précis que oui, voilà, j'aimerais bien accéder à une procédure d'asile, mais simplement j'exprime ma peur d'être renvoyé vers un pays où je pourrais après être renvoyé vers mon pays d'origine, il faut tenir compte de cela parce que le principe ultime, le principe primordial, c'est évidemment sauver la vie d'une personne et éviter qu'il ne soit exposé à des violations des droits de l'homme. Ce respect du principe de non-refoulement est également énoncé dans divers instruments du Conseil de l'Europe. Hein, nous avons les 20 principes directeurs sur le retour forcé, qui a été adopté par le comité des ministres en 2005. Nous avons les excellents rapports de Mme Fiala et Strick, l'un sur les migrants et réfugiés et l'autre sur les accords de réadmission, et on y reviendra peut-être après au cours de la discussion. Et ce sont également donc des rapports que vraiment j'encourage à lire, puisqu'ils permettent, ils rappellent ce principe de non-refoulement. De manière concrète, alors, que faire? Que faire pour concilier le principe de non-refoulement avec le droit des États de contrôler leurs frontières et de mettre en place des politiques de gestion des flux migratoires? C'est cela qui est important. Essayer de trouver ensemble des réponses concrètes. Tout d'abord, avant de prendre une décision de retour, les États doivent s'assurer qu'une alternative au retour n'est pas possible. La régularisation pourrait en être une. La rapporteure, Mme Strick, encourage cette solution dans son rapport. Et cela serait le premier pas vers une intégration qui est l'une des solutions durables que préconise le HCR. Les États doivent également s'assurer que le principe de non-refoulement est respecté à tous les stages, mais également que la personne vers laquelle le pays vers lequel on renvoie la personne est réellement un pays sûr. Je pense qu'il est également important de tenir compte de la situation particulière de l'individu, et on l'a dit ce matin, quelqu'un qui a été victime de trafic, un enfant mineur, quelqu'un qui a été traumatisé à l'issue de violences, quelqu'un qui va peut-être devenir apatride par suite du retour, parce que le pays d'origine ne veut plus l'accepter. Donc il faut avoir en compte tout cela lorsqu'on prend une décision de retour, et il faut éviter le retour forcé abusif. J'ai peu de temps et donc on va peut-être en revenir là-dessus sur le débat, mais je voudrais juste dire qu'il faut être optimiste et qu'il y a déjà des exemples de bonnes pratiques qui montrent qu'avec un meilleur engagement des États, une meilleure coopération entre les États, on peut trouver des réponses à ces questions. Je vous remercie.
Thank you very much, Olivier, for this presentation and all this reflection on non-refoulement principle. And now Nuala Mol is going to speak for 15 minutes on the forced return and all whatever.
Thank you very much indeed. Yesterday, I became one gentleman sitting at this table, and today I have become another gentleman with a different passport and a different nationality, and I'm seriously concerned that the Schengen information system is not going to let me leave Portugal today, as I clearly have so many aliases. I'm going to be put on the police computer now. So you will forgive the very imperfect and amateur nature of this intervention, because I didn't know I was speaking about forced returns until late last night. But I have a horrible reputation in my office for not being able to say no, so I said yes. I just want to remind us that the context of forced returns is, and Olivier already alluded to this, is not confined to people who have ever been asylum seekers or are just refused asylum seekers, but applies to all individuals who find themselves in a country other than their country of citizenship, where they are unable to obtain the permission to remain and are being returned either to a country they passed through, and we may talk about readmission agreements later, or to their country of origin. And within Europe, within the 27 member states of the Council of Europe, there are at least, and I'm not disregarding the other international frameworks here, but at least four regimes which regulate the return of individuals to their countries of origin: the Geneva Convention on the Status of Refugees, the European Convention on Human Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the United Nations Convention Against Torture, all of which regulate to a greater or lesser degree the issue which is the subject of our discussion this morning. And those apply in all 47 member states. The EU asylum acquis applies more or less in the 27 member states of the EU. But the EU returns directive, which is what we're going to be talking about sometime this morning, and which is the EU instrument guaranteeing returns, applies only in the 24 member states of the EU who are full partners in the Schengen system, because the EU returns directive was adopted as a development of the Schengen acquis and in particular of the Schengen Borders Code. The Schengen Borders Code has only limited participation by Denmark, the UK and Ireland, but confusingly also includes places like Liechtenstein and Switzerland and Iceland and Norway to a greater or lesser extent. So now you're all thoroughly confused. And so are we. And the trouble is, everybody in this room has to work their way through the maze of overlapping instruments which now apply to the issue of returning migrants. Olivier has just spoken very clearly and eloquently about the principle of the non-refoulement of people who are entitled to international protection, not just those who qualify for refugee status under the Geneva Convention on the Status of Refugees, but also those who are entitled to what is known in the European Union as subsidiary protection. And he would be the first person to agree that the remarks that he made apply also to individuals who do not fall within the protection of the Qualification Directive, but who are, as a matter of international human rights law and under the European Convention on Human Rights, people who are absolutely prohibited from being returned because their return would violate their right to be protected from torture or inhuman or degrading treatment or their right to life. So these are the people who are protected by Article 2 of the European Convention, the right to life, Article 3, the prohibition on torture or inhuman or degrading treatment, Protocol 6, the prohibition of the death penalty, and Protocol 13, the prohibition of the death penalty in time of war. Under no circumstances can anybody be returned from any of the 47 member states of the Council of Europe to those countries. And yet the national systems for enforcing those protected rights fail time and again, and individuals regularly and in ever-increasing numbers find themselves having to have recourse to the European Court of Human Rights in order to seek the vindication of those rights and the protection which their national authorities, including their national courts, have been unwilling to give them. But there are also people whose return to their country of origin is regulated by the European Convention on Human Rights and other international standards. And as Christina mentioned earlier, this can include Article 8. Article 8, the private life rubric of which protects people from return if their moral and physical integrity would be disproportionately damaged by such a return. So this is people whose situation does not reach the very high threshold of severity, level of seriousness, which is required for Article 3 to be engaged, but whose moral and physical integrity, their physical and psychological well-being, would be so seriously damaged by being returned that it cannot be proportionate to remove them in the interests of immigration control. Similarly, Article 9, freedom of religion, Article 10, freedom of speech, Article 11, freedom of association and assembly, and Article 12, the right to marry. These are all provisions which act to impede states from freely returning undocumented foreigners whose expulsion would otherwise be entirely within national sovereignty, but very often states fail to take into proper account these other considerations before they return. And coming back to Article 8 and the right to respect for family and private life, and Article 12, the right to marry, because in many cases, individuals who have either come legally and overstayed, as Olivier mentioned, or have come clandestinely but been in the country for a long time, or who are refused asylum seekers, will have formed perfectly genuine relationships with individuals in the host country and will sometimes have founded families there. And it is very difficult to persuade the national authorities that these family relations should act as an impediment to expulsion. But on many, many occasions now, the European Court of Human Rights has overturned the national authorities' assessment of the decision to expel and found that it would violate the right to respect for family life because it is not reasonable to expect the whole family to uproot itself from the host state in Europe and relocate to the country of the proposed expellee. Problems also arise because citizens of the European Union are entitled to travel to any other member state of the European Union and take with them their spouses and children of whatever nationality. But sometimes states try to frustrate this right by not permitting migrants who are in an irregular situation to marry so that they cannot take advantage of the right to live in another EU member state because of the national policies of one member state. The other issue is those who have regular status and have sometimes been lawfully resident for many years in the country, but commit criminal offences and are then threatened with expulsion as a consequence of having committed criminal offences. Time and again in our office, we are obliged to have recourse to the Strasbourg procedure in order to challenge the proportionality of such cases. 9 cases out of 10 are settled by the governments immediately they are communicated to them. They have been fought all the way through national proceedings, but the minute the Strasbourg court is seized, they cave in and say the individual can stay. Sometimes they go to a judgment, and we just recently won a case in which the individual had been granted permanent residence in the United Kingdom and then committed a criminal offence and was removed just after that criminal offence had been committed. The offence was so trivial that it would not even have justified removal as a matter of national law, and so they predicated it on some conduct which had taken place many years before he was granted permanent residence. It's very difficult to have constantly to be second-guessing imperfect decision-making. And I want to come back to the asylum-related issues. And as Olivier has reminded us, a refused asylum seeker is not necessarily not a refugee. A refused asylum seeker is just somebody that the states have not recognized as a refugee. And individuals who have been refused recognition as refugees or refused international protection of a comparable kind are frequently required also to have recourse to the European Court of Human Rights in order to challenge their expulsion to the country of origin. This is a relatively simple case to deal with if you are dealing with expulsion to the country where they are at risk of torture or inhuman or degrading treatment, and the country from which they came and which provoked them to seek asylum in the first case, in the first place. You either have the evidence to support their case or you don't. Simple. Much more complicated is where, as Christina alluded, the returns are to other countries of the European Union, where there is a twofold risk. Firstly, there is a risk that the inadequacies of the asylum determination procedure in the country of proposed return is such that there is no guarantee that the very purpose of the Dublin regulation will be met, which is to ensure that an individual who seeks asylum in one member state of the European Union will have his or her asylum claim determined somewhere in the European Union. And I'm afraid the elephant in the room is the expression. We are none of us really talking about Greece, but I've said it now. Greece is the big problem, because Greece, unfortunately, has found itself unwilling or unable to have in place a proper asylum determination process in accordance with the EU procedures directive, a proper assessment of people's needs under the EU qualification directive, and a proper implementation of reception conditions. So there is a very real risk that anyone who is returned to Greece will not have their asylum claim determined anywhere in the European Union. In addition, as the case of SD against Greece, which was decided by the European Court recently, the flagrant disregard of the rule of law in relation to detention and the total absence of proper reception conditions make it clear that the treatment that to which people will be subjected when they arrive in Greece also engages the human rights responsibility of the sending state, even if there were not a risk of them being onward refouled to a country where they claim their primary risk is. It's not possible for the lawyers who are trying to act on behalf of asylum seekers there even to get into the detention centres to take instructions from their clients. They can't get any epethini dilosi, they can't get the bit of paper that gets you in unless they've got any epethini dilosi, the bit of paper which says the detainee is instructing them. So it's a shambolic mess, as we say in English. Hope the interpreters can translate shambolic mess into some suitable phrase. I want to conclude by saying that there are three kinds of forced returns. The first kind of forced returns, and I'm not going crazy, are voluntary returns. Most voluntary returns are, of course, not voluntary returns at all. They're forced returns where the individual is told under the provisions of the returns directive, you have to go, but if you go now without us having to push you, it will be less serious for you than if we have to push you. So these are voluntary returns, which are often actually involuntary returns. Then there are the truly involuntary returns, which is when people don't respond to the suggestion that they should make a voluntary return and are forcibly removed. And at the top end of the spectrum, there are physically forced returns. That is, forced returns where individuals who resist the return sometimes resist it so forcibly that they attempt suicide before being put on the planes are taken to an aeroplane in conditions which frequently, or in using a degree of force which frequently engages the prohibition on inhuman and degrading treatment under Article 3. There have been no cases as yet brought to the European Court on Human Rights on this provision, but there is a comprehensive jurisprudence on the prohibition on undue force, which exists in relation to ordinary arrests in the context of the criminal justice, and which is equally applicable to forced returns. The forced returns of individuals, I give you an example. If you want to go to the European Court of Human Rights and ask for interim measures to prevent a state from carrying out a forced return, because the individual will be at such a risk if returned, you have to be able to tell the court when that person is likely to be expelled. In the United Kingdom, you can go to the court because the person will have received what are called removal directions, a piece of paper which says when they're actually going to be put on the plane. But if there is suicide risk, if they have threatened, if there is a credible reason to believe that they will try to commit suicide if they are returned, they're not told when they're going to be returned, because the British don't want them to commit suicide in the UK. They'd rather they waited till they got home and then committed suicide. So people who are at suicide risk are not even notified of when they're going to be returned, and we have had a real uphill task persuading the European Court to give the protection of its interim measures to people who are not going to be notified of their return. I don't doubt, and I throw this now out, and maybe I'm usurping the chairman's job here, I would like to have talked about diplomatic assurances, readmission agreements, absolute prohibition, family reunion, all those other things, but there isn't time, so I hope you're going to ask pertinent and interesting questions about all the things that I'd really like to talk about. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dula. As we have no many minutes before lunch, Thomas, he is a gentleman, decided not to speak right now and to start the debate and afterwards to close the session. So please, anyone here who want to ask something, please do it, and if possible, if you want to, say your name or organization in order to be in a closer cell. Who would like to start by asking one other or everybody at the table? Yes? Is there a micro? Yes.
Hello. Good. John Greenway, I think you probably know I'm chairman of the Migration Committee in the Council of Europe Parliamentary Assembly. I'd like to congratulate our two speakers, but particularly Nuala, who gave a tour de force of this whole subject at such short notice. And we're extremely grateful. I understand it much better than I ever did before, and certainly more than I did half an hour ago. And it provoked in my mind this thought that, as you know, the Assembly adopted a report I did about 18 months ago, or maybe slightly longer, about regularization programs for irregular migrants. And we have this ongoing battle, particularly in the UK, but in other countries as well, where there is an absolute refusal, publicly at least, to face up to the reality that many people simply cannot be returned. But the policy is, we don't regularize you. The only other alternative is return. And I just wondered whether you might want to comment on a little bit further your point about, I think it was Articles 4 and 12, right to family life, right to marry, because as far as I can see, most of the cases in relation to people in an irregular situation that I'm aware of in the UK, and many other MPs of the past have had similar experience, it would appear to me that Articles 4 and 12 apply absolutely to them. And yet we still have this policy that says we don't regularise anybody. People stupidly use the word amnesty. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about actually regularising people into a situation where inevitably in the future they may have a normal life and the possibility of then returning on a voluntary basis, which they don't have at the moment, because the minute they leave the country, they never get back.
We can join two or three questions because of the time. Who wants to ask us something? There's no other question? Yes, there is.
Well, my name is Anton van Kallentuit. I'm a member of the CPT and professor in criminal law and migration law in Tilburg, the Netherlands. My question is the following. Do you think that there is a responsibility for the national authorities to monitor the people that are expelled to the other countries? Because I asked that last week in the Netherlands, we had the case that, and it is not the first time, that people sent to Libya or Syria immediately at the airport were arrested, put in prison, and never we got any information what happened with them. The Dutch government says that is not our responsibility. We send them back to the airport, and then it is the responsibility of the national authorities. What do you think is the responsibility of the sending state? Can they say that it's not their responsibility?
Other question, please?
I'm Jelena von Hendel from IFNET. I wanted to ask you about joint forced returns, which are practiced. Joint forced returns, which are practiced by EU member states. And because I think that there is a lack of transparency as far as these returns are concerned, so I would like to hear your maybe your experience and more information about how it is carried out.
Thank you. I'm not really a specialist. I don't really know the legal framework of for refugees and asylum seekers in Europe. But I would like to ask you, if I'm not wrong, concerning the return directive, what do you think about the economic incentives even for forced returnees?
I believe I may speak in Portuguese. Boa tarde. Eu tenho estado aqui a assistir, meu nome é João Ataí. There's no translation for Portuguese, then I'm trying to speak in English. No,
Channel 12 is Portuguese into English for the benefit of anyone.
So may I speak in my own language?
Please.
Okay, thank you so much. Mas eu estava a dizer, eu estou aqui, o meu nome é João Ataíde, pertenço ao Serviço de Transições e Fronteiras e estou aqui, enfim, eu participo de uma forma em todo o processo, tanto de produção legislativa, aplicação da lei a nível português e comunitário. E permitam-me um desabafo, mais que uma pergunta, é um desabafo. Quem assistir estes dois dias parece que a União Europeia é um sítio horroroso que viola todos os direitos onde ninguém quer viver. Bom, eu penso que também é importante aqui sublinhar, há uma palavra de esperança. Estamos aqui num workshop sobre afastamento. Eu recordo, por exemplo, só a título de exemplo, que a Malásia expulsa por ano tantas pessoas como toda a União Europeia. enfim. Portanto, enfim, eu penso que a União Europeia é uma construção que podemos concordar ou não, política de Estados soberanos que durante mil anos se criaram e, portanto, estão a construir algo em comum e se tentam harmonizar. É um local que tem um acervo de direitos e uma tutela dos direitos de todas as pessoas que não há paralelo no mundo moderno, parece-me a mim, e não só consagra esses direitos, como tem mecanismos que visam proteger e fiscalizar, sejam a opinião pública, os tribunais, um conjunto de entidades que, de facto, sancionam todas as práticas. Eu penso que era importante haver uma palavra de esperança e, de facto, dizer que o acervo comunitário com o legal, que eu penso que às vezes poderá não ser perfeito, como nenhuma lei perfeita, hein? Mas era importante haver uma palavra de esperança e dizer que, de qualquer modo, a União Europeia é composto por Estados de Direito. E, portanto, que cumprem a lei, portanto, há problemas, mas para isso é que estão cá os tribunais, as opiniões públicas, as organizações governamentais para fiscalizar isso. Desculpem, mas eu penso que era um ponto importante para não entrarmos também num excesso de negativismo que, de facto, penso que também não é muito positivo. Era só. Muito obrigado e desculpem.
Otherwise, we are not going to be on time, no? The last question. Who is the last question? Who is going to ask? Yes? All right. Here at the second. Where is the micro? Yes, here, please. Microphone.
First of all, I'd like to genuinely thank the panel. I think it was a very thorough and in many ways a very objective assessment of the situation. However, I do share the sentiments expressed by my Portuguese colleague. Negativity breeds negativity. There are 27 sovereign states, and the reality is that the situation in the EU is probably the best in the world. Needless to say, it can't be improved. And the EU has acknowledged this. There's a complete overhaul being done, and I think we are at a moment of opportunity. And we should seize this opportunity, because the post-Lisbon scenario, and particularly the setting up even of the European Asylum Support Office, which, for instance, will allow it is envisaged that twice a year this agency will have a platform of discussions with NGOs, civil society, and all key players. I mean, I think there are some opportunities. The other comment I would like to place is, Mrs. Noel spoke, Nuala spoke about, Nuala spoke about the elephant in the room. It's an expression that I love and I used it yesterday. And there I will mention the other elephant in the room. The other elephant in the room is I may sound like a broken record, but I think it is where the problem lies. States are reluctant to observe the existence, to respect the complex, as Nuala has mentioned, very complex maze of legal norms that they have created. They're reluctant because they are under a lot of pressure. I don't need to speak in Greece's defense, but Greece is in a very difficult situation. Very difficult situation. And we have to acknowledge that the Prime Minister has committed himself to a complete overhaul of the situation. Whether this will happen or not is not for me to judge. But it is very convenient for many states to take the moral high ground, knowing that there is a convenient buffer zone of states in the Mediterranean who are shouldering an incredibly disproportionate burden. And I think unless even we as a Council of Europe, we as NGOs, we as civil societies, unless we show states that we do acknowledge, not just by lip service, but in a real way, we antagonize states. There are people who are underpaid. I have spoken to people who are underpaid, who have risked their lives, Maltese people who risk their lives on a daily basis. I have seen videos of babies being passed on in 9-foot waves, helicopters trying to pick up people. I mean, over the last 10 years, a very, very small group of people have saved over 12,000 lives in the Mediterranean. These are people who are genuinely committed. I have spoken to people who told me, once I've had to choose. I had to choose. I had to save either the mother or her two children. She said, unfortunately, the mother didn't make it. I mean, so, yes, we do have a lot of work to do. But I join my Portuguese colleague. Negativity breeds negativity. And I apologize for taking the floor for a long time. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Then I think that Olivier and Nuala, they are going to answer. Oh, perfect.
Je veux juste clarifier que nous sommes tout à fait d'accord qu'il faut une meilleure coopération entre États et qu'il est important d'assurer un suivi dans les pays d'origine. Il faut mettre en place des mécanismes de suivi. Et lorsqu'il n'est pas possible de mettre en place des mécanismes de suivi, on peut alors se poser la question sur la question est-ce que c'est un pays sûr, oui ou non, où l'on peut renvoyer quelqu'un. Donc passer un accord de réadmission, par exemple, avec un pays, on ne peut pas vérifier que ce pays respecte les obligations internationales en la matière, ça peut poser des questions. Je crois que la responsabilité ultime de l'État qui renvoie les personnes est maintenue même lorsque cette personne est renvoyée vers un pays tiers et non pas vers le pays d'origine. C'est le pays qui renvoie qui est l'ultime responsable. Et je voudrais terminer en disant qu'il y a des pratiques de suivi dans certains pays qui ont été mises en place, cela existe, et cela est très profitable, elles impliquent la société civile, elles impliquent même les rapatriés, parce qu'évidemment le but est d'éviter que les personnes ne reviennent, et je pense qu'il faut qu'il y ait un retour durable, si on envisage ce retour durable. Merci.
I'm just going to go very quickly, because of the time constraints, in reverse order, through the points that were raised. Firstly, in relation to our Maltese colleague's point about the marvellous work that members of the Maltese Navy and other naval officers and crew do in the context of search and rescue and SOLAS, safety of life at sea operations in the Mediterranean, I think we would all commend with all our hearts the wonderful work that they do. But those are law of the sea. Search and rescue operations and safety of life at sea. These are not immigration control operations, or ought not to be. The safety of life at sea is the duty that states have, and the wonderful work that they do is in the context of the duty to preserve life, which has always been a fundamental element of the law of the sea. Greece. Greece is a country which I have lived in for more than 40 years. I'm a real Philhellene. And it's because I love Greece so much that I feel entitled to criticize it. I'm not criticizing what Greece cannot do now because of its serious economic problems. I'm not criticizing Greece's failure to have put into place proper reception conditions and so forth to deal with the major influxes of people who are arriving. I'm criticizing the other member states of the EU who want to keep adding to Greece's problems by sending back to Greece all the people they could perfectly well deal with in their own countries if they exercise the sovereignty clause under Article 3.2 of the Dublin Regulation. We do not need to add to Greece's problems by sending them even more asylum seekers than they've got already that they cannot accommodate and they cannot process. The EU asylum acquis is not all bad. As well as being a Philhellene for 40 years, I was one of the very first people ever to go to the College of Europe in Bruges 40 years ago, and have always been a committed European, if you like. The EU asylum acquis has introduced so many good things into the processing of asylum applications across the 27 member states of the EU, particularly in those countries that were not accustomed to receiving asylum seekers, countries that had previously been countries of emigration. And it has introduced some very, very commendable minimum standards, minimum procedures, reception conditions, where there were none. What has been unacceptable in the EU Asylum Acquis and the Returns Directive has been the fact that states were reluctant to include in any of those measures, not the European Commission, but the member states were reluctant to allow those measures to go forward, including the very safeguards which they are all obliged to comply with because of their obligations under the European Convention on Human Rights. That's my criticism of the Asylum Acquis. Economic incentives for forced returns. If people are given a genuine choice whether or not to return and the state is willing to give them some pocket money to go back with, I see no reason why people shouldn't be given some pocket money to go back with. I have no objection in principle to that. And if they decide that they're going to come back, then they will keep the smuggling and trafficking business going by using the money that they've been given. Joint forced returns, lack of individual assessment, collective expulsion of aliens is a problem. It's very difficult to put because this all goes on in secret, but we know that suddenly somebody who was not going to be removed on Tuesday is going to be removed on Wednesday because there's an empty seat on the plane. And you've got over-hasty, inappropriate, non-substantive assessment of people just to, for economic reasons, to fill the empty seats on the planes when they've got a flight that's running around Europe collecting up people and then dumping them somewhere else. Responsibility of the sending state to monitor returns. Certainly the Human Rights Committee has obliged states to monitor returns. In the Agiza and Sweden cases, in the Bosnian cases, there has been necessity to monitor what happened to people. Most recently, the European Court of Human Rights has indicated to the UK government that it must act very assertively in relation to the Iraqi civilians who were handed over to Iraq to face charges which could attract the death penalty when there was a Rule 39 indication extant against them. And we are working very hard within the Committee of Ministers to ensure that the couple of cases against Italy, where Italy expelled people in flagrant breach of Rule 39 indications, interim measures, which had been ordered by the European Court, putting pressure on Italy to execute the judgment of the court, finding that this was a violation of the right of the exercise of individual petition, that they must be making massive efforts to ensure that no harm comes to those people in Tunisia. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just a short, very last comment concerning, again, the monitoring mechanisms and whether it belongs to state to the state's responsibility question posed by Antonius. For the time being, we have the return directive within the EU, which clearly sets forth an obligation for the EU member states in Article 8, Para 6, that member states shall build on, shall establish effective monitoring procedures on forced return. And as far as I know, the Netherlands is one of the pioneers who are already fulfill these obligations and within Commission, or there is some mechanism to monitor forced return, but maybe it's not the case that it's completely that is perfect. And within the Commission working group on implementation of the return directive, there have been some seminars and discussions on best practices and how to do that, how to implement these provisions. So we have now an obligation, and we'll see from the beginning of next year how it will work in practice.
So, thank you very much to Olivier Baer, to Nuala Moll, and to Thomas Monarch, who will make the summary at the plenary of this workshop. And thank you to you for your contribution and for being here. Thank you very much.